Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
Fantastic.
Well, good. I don't think we have too much to say at the top other than check out our Patreon because we have bonus episodes over there. We've got like almost 40 of them. And when this episode comes out, I think there should be a poll for voting on what story you would like to hear. Our patrons get to vote on the stories they like to hear. So that's cool. Patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Check it out.
Get it while it's hot.
Yeah. But on that note, what are your thoughts on volcanoes?
Hot.
That's true.
Stinky.
Yeah, sulfur.
Never been, though.
No, me neither.
Actually, in person. So this is just what I hear.
Would you take a trip to an active volcano?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I get it. Like, statistically speaking, it's not a very dangerous thing to do. But after this story, I don't know. I feel like I know way too much to have chill.
Just don't think about Pompeii. Think about the cool magma and the rocks.
Cool magma? Oh, like seeing it?
Yeah.
Like sure.
As in the vibe. Cool.
I understand.
Yeah.
This volcano eruption was not magma. It was just like hot
kaboom.
Ash, rocks, projectiles, acid, all that stuff.
Okay.
Steam.
It's part of the job, I guess. But I would still go because I'm very interested in volcanoes. I had a whole phase as a child, like, fixated on volcanoes.
Really? That's cool.
Actually, I think my science project involved, like, a volcano.
Classic elementary school science fair.
Yeah.
Paper mache volcano.
Yeah, I didn't make it, like, blow up, but I, like, modeled it. I don't really remember, but I was just like, this shit looks cool.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the type of volcano we're going to be talking about today is, like, the ones that you would see at a science fair, like a cone shape, so...
Really?
Yeah, okay. We'll get into that. I have it in my notes.
Yeah, where is it?
New Zealand.
Okay.
Why don't we just get started?
Yeah, I guess, you know.
Do you have questions already?
Yeah, well, I just didn't know New Zealand was part of an active volcano range.
Yeah, I think actually New Zealand is a very active volcanic area in general. And this volcano, Fakari Volcano on White Island, is one of the most active volcanoes in the area for sure, but maybe in the world. I don't know that for certain, but it's a very active volcano.
Cool.
All right, let's get started. As I just said, Fakari Volcano on White Island is New Zealand's most active volcano. It is extremely active, erupting every few years, and is located on the Bay of Plenty, which is located just off the northeast coast of New Zealand. The volcano rises more than 1,000 feet, above ground, but most of it is actually underwater. It's called a submarine volcano because 2/3 of it is underwater. So what you're seeing above water on land is only 1/3 of the volcano.
What does that mean, though? Like, if a volcano exists on an island, period, isn't most of it, like, technically underground? Like, it goes all the way to the core.
No, so right? the island is the volcano.
I see.
Yeah. So the whole volcano is underwater almost, and just like the top third of it is above the water, and you can go onto the top third of it and like walk up to the top of the crater and like look down into what's called Crater Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't like pull up boats like directly to the island. We're going to get into all this, but like you kind of have to like take a little dinghy out there because like it's a very rocky, not hospitable place to be, really. The island is only the volcano. It's not like a big booming island with like other things around it. It's like literally just the volcano.
So you get there by dinghy?
You get there by ferry and then you take a dinghy to the island, yes. Or helicopter. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Okay. Well, I guess I was confused because I'm like, okay, what does the two-thirds underground end at? You know, doesn't it kind of technically go down forever? Or like a long, long way? I'm thinking like Mariana Trench, you know?
I don't know that. I don't know.
What I mean?
I mean, it's like the bottom of the ocean. I don't know.
Does it hit the ocean floor?
I guess.
It's like, this is where it starts.
I suppose.
Because they're really just like the Earth's pimples, right?
You know? In a way, sure.
In a way. So.
So think of the bottom of the volcano as like the face.
The face.
Okay. Let's keep going.
Sure.
The volcano is a very popular tourist destination in New Zealand. Since the 90s, hundreds of thousands of people have set foot on the volcano. 18,000 people each year were visiting the volcano. It's very active and has erupted over the last decade, but that did not stop tourism. There's two ways to get to the island, as I just mentioned. You can go by helicopter or by ferry boat from Whakatane, New Zealand. It is, yeah.
Whakatane?
Whakatane? It's with a WH, but it's pronounced with an F. So I apologize if I'm butchering that. Whakatane.
It's a fun one.
Yeah. The helicopter ride is about 20 minutes to the volcano, but the boat ride is about 80 to 90 minutes. Once you arrive on the island, you get to take a hike to the caldera, which is the large volcanic crater at the middle of the peak, which is the highlight of the tour. The caldera is formed after a large eruption. The magma chamber beneath the volcano empties and then it collapses in on itself, creating the crater. After an old sulfur mine on the island closed in the 1930s, the whole island was completely abandoned for decades until it found new life as a tourist attraction. Tourism New Zealand promoted White Island as a travel destination to travel agents as adventure tourism, and for a very long time it was considered one of New Zealand's hidden gems as far as like tourism goes. It became so popular that multiple tour groups were brought there daily by boat and by helicopter. The island is generally rugged with cliffs surrounding most of the coast, so ferry boats that take the tours out to the island can't dock on the island. They have to anchor further away and then take smaller inflatable boats from the ferry to the island. White Island tours became a very important part of Whakatane, which is the town east of the Bay of Plenty. The population there is around 17,000 people, and tours were a very important aspect of their local economy. On December 4th, 2019, the Royal Caribbean cruise ship Ovation of the Seas set sail from Sydney, Australia to New Zealand for a 12-day cruise. Thousands of Australians bought tickets for this cruise, and as one of the perks, all of the passengers were offered a day trip to White Island. They could walk around an active volcano. And the opportunity to visit the island was actually a big selling point for this cruise for so many of the passengers in the first place. So there were a bunch of people who specifically booked this cruise because they wanted to go to White Island. Not everyone on board booked the cruise because of the volcano. Other passengers had no idea that there would be a volcano tour ticket included in their time on the ship, potentially. But then they chose last minute to go, thinking it might be a cool thing to see.
Well, yeah. It's a volcano.
Yeah.
That's active.
Right. So everyone who went that day was given a brochure with safety precautions and whatever else the cruise line thought they should know, which really wasn't much. But it told passengers they could, quote, get close to the drama. Hard hats and gas masks would be provided so that they could get close to the roaming steam vents, bubbling pits of mud, hot volcanic steams, and the amazing lake of steaming acid. All passengers had to do was wear closed-toed shoes, and they should be prepared for a strenuous hike, and wheelchair users were discouraged from attending, but other than that, the cruise line would take care of everything. So, really, the only thing they had to be concerned about was wearing closed-toed shoes. The cruise line didn't give them any sort of information about the status of the volcano at the time, like whether it was close to erupting or not. It was just like, wear closed-toed shoes and go walk around the volcano.
Are you able to know that?
Yes. We're going to
see.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll talk about that.
Cool, cool, cool.
Right. So the island is extremely beautiful. It looks like another planet, honestly. The acid is really colorful. There are bubbling mud pools, sulfur crystals, geothermal vents, hot springs, and so much more. It's really cool to see. But so December 9th was the day that the crews would be taking their trip to White Island for a six-hour tour. About 100 tourists were loaded onto three boats called the PJ-4, the Phoenix, and the Tiapua Fakari, all run by White Island Tours. The PJ-4 left at 9:30 in the morning, followed by the Phoenix at 10:30, and then the Tiapua Fakari left at 11:30. There were also two helicopters going out that day from Volcanic Air, which would be bringing passengers to the volcano around the same time as the boats. One of the helicopters to the island that day was piloted by Brian DePau. He had a group of four German tourists with him on the helicopter. There were also Brazilian tourists Alessandro Kaufman and his wife Aline, who were on their way to the island with passengers on the Phoenix, which was the second boat that went out that day. Alessandro had been taking video footage all day to document his adventure, so much of the footage of the day and of the eruption comes from him and like his time there. And he got some really insane footage of the eruption. Boat passengers were given a small metal cone with a colored dot as a boarding pass, and they handed the cones to the crew members as they boarded as a physical record of how many people were on board. They were all given gas masks and yellow hard hats, and crew members wore orange hats and striped shirts so they could be easily picked out from the passengers. The boats dropped their anchors near the island, and then the crew loaded their passengers into smaller boats, and then they were taken onto the island. Crew members helped them off the small boats onto a jetty, which is a small dock at the edge of the island, and it's really the only place to get on and off of the island since the whole thing is extremely rocky with volcanic rocks around the whole perimeter. But before they began hiking, there was a brief safety meeting. Everyone was reminded to stay on the path and in between tour guides at all times. They were warned not to touch anything or to take anything. There was no safety briefing about what to do in the occasion of an eruption. It was just like, stay within the tour group and don't touch anything, basically.
And think happy thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the passengers that were there that day were saying like, yeah, I had a lot of anxiety being on the island because like we knew it was an active volcano and it like, you know, kind of made you feel a little adrenaline rush, but mostly everyone felt safe. Like they didn't think anything was going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, you don't go on the island if you think it's going to erupt.
Right.
You know.
The guides led them up the winding path toward the crater, past various sulfur deposits and vents, and as they got closer, passengers began putting on their gas masks. There were clouds of white steam rising from the ground, and the group stepped around what looked like a pond of steam. The water was boiling hot, at least 100 degrees Celsius, or 212 degrees Fahrenheit. One of the guides warned them not to get too close and reminded everyone to put on their masks if they needed, and if they got caught in a cloud of steam, to turn around and crouch down. The path to the caldera was rocky, but the passengers were having a great time. The island was an incredible thing to see. Algae turns the streams green and brown and red. Yellow sulfur crystals brighten up the rocks. It's just a really colorful place. And there aren't many places you can go to see things like that. Crater Lake was at the center of the island, and that area isn't very hot, but it's highly acidic and has a constant stream of steam coming off of it. When the wind blows, it briefly clears the steam to reveal glimpses of the lake, and it's very much the highlight of the tour. What's unique about the crater is it's in the shape of an amphitheater, so it has very steep sides, and you're basically enclosed by the walls of the crater, and there's like, I think, one way basically in and out of it. So there's not a great way to get in and out of it in the case of an emergency. I mean, it is like a large area to get in and out, but like there's only that one spot. Mm-hmm. Just before 2 p.m., as the groups from the Phoenix started heading back down the path, they spotted Brian's Volcanic Air helicopter on the landing pad. The Phoenix was waiting near the shore and was ready for passengers to get back on board. The sky was bright and clear, and everything was calm on the island. And the passengers weren't super rushed to get back on the boat either. So they were kind of taking their time, they were taking pictures, you know, kind of moseying over to the dock to get back on the dinghy and then back to the Phoenix. The PJ-4 boat had already started to head back to the mainland, and the Fakari boat had just arrived around 1 p.m., and all of its 42 passengers and crew members were now, like, making their way up to the crater. The passengers on the boat were divided into two groups of 19 and were each led by two guides. Kelsey Waghorn led the first group up the path to Crater Lake, assisted by 19-year-old Jake Milbank, who was celebrating his birthday that day. 40-year-old Hayden Marshall Inman led the second group, which was assisted by 24-year-old Tiffany Mengi. This was actually Hayden's 1,111th trip to the volcano.
What? The guide?
Yeah. His father...
That's so crazy.
Yeah, his father, Alan, had been a White Island tour guide before him and had gone 300 times, but he has gone well beyond that.
Yeah, beat your record, Dad.
Yeah. When people asked Hayden and his father why they went so many times and, like, why they liked it, they said it was because the place was never the same place twice. It was constantly changing and there was new things to see all the time.
That's super interesting.
Yeah. Hayden was actually a skipper, but was filling in as a cruise ship guide for the cruise ship passengers, so he was leading up that group to the crater. Around 2 o'clock, Kelsey's group was almost back to the shore, and the passengers of the Phoenix had almost gotten back on board, and the first helicopter from Volcanic Air had left the island at 2:05. Brian was preparing his four passengers to board the helicopter and planned to take off in just a few minutes. Hayden's group from the Fakari boat was headed up the path to Crater Lake at that point, and 23-year-old Stephanie Browett was in that group with her father Paul and her sister Crystal, who was 21 years old. Their mother Marie had actually stayed back that day on the cruise ship, and just the three of them were going a tour of the volcano. The family had taken this cruise to celebrate Crystal's 21st birthday, and when they heard about the day trip to White Island, Stephanie, Crystal, and their father Paul made the very spontaneous decision to participate. Stephanie was excited for the tour because it seemed like a really cool thing to do, and she had never seen a volcano before, and she had never even heard of the volcano before being on the cruise for her sister's birthday, so it seemed like a spontaneous, fun thing to do, an adventure to take. As their group hiked up to Crater Lake, Stephanie was having a really great time. The island was beautiful, but the pockets of gas made her a little bit uneasy. Within half an hour of getting on the island, Stephanie and Crystal began getting a little worried after they heard their guide talking about the volcano. As they approached the rim, he had been saying that the volcano was actually at a volcanic alert level of 2 and was nearing 3. Once a volcano hits level 3, that means it is actively erupting.
Oh, well, so, level 2 doesn't sound like that.
Right. They learned while they were on the volcano, basically at the crater, that this volcano was on a level 2, which is the stage directly before eruption.
Very serene, very calming news.
Yeah.
Does the lake at least look cool?
I mean, yeah, it looks really cool on the island, for sure. And Crystal had actually been recording a video at the time. So in her video, you can hear the guide talking about the stage the volcano is at and basically shows that they were aware that this was a risky thing to be doing. The tour guide was anxious the entire time they were on the volcano because he knew what level they were at, and he actually decided to cut the tour short and begin heading back early because he was that worried about it. Stephanie wasn't sure what level 2 meant, but the fact that the tour was getting cut short, she felt like it was probably a bad sign. What they didn't know was that the level 2 warning had been in place for weeks. The island is monitored by GNS Science with 3 web cameras and seismograph and a microphone to detect volcanic explosions, and the organization also makes regular visits to test water, gas, and soil, and to survey the surface deformation. So New Zealand's Volcanic Monitoring Authority put out a message saying White Island may be entering a period where eruptive activity is more likely than normal. And that had been out for weeks.
Okay. Well, let me ask, how often does that happen?
I don't think super often. Because okay. The volcano erupts like, I mean, this is an active volcano and it's like a pretty active one, but like it erupted every couple of years.
Okay. But I'm just like, that wording and language is not very urgent.
I guess.
More likely than usual doesn't mean anything to me.
Sure. But after the last eruption in 2016, scientists had gotten a warning about how dangerous an eruption could truly be. Like if there were people on the island. The eruption in 2016 was similar to the one that we're going to talk about today, and the only difference was that the eruption that happened in 2016 happened at night, so nobody was on the island. But if anyone had been on the island, there would have been probably no survivors, so they knew that this could happen and that where the tours were taken was exactly where the explosion would happen and like come at.
Oh my god. So they're right in the line of fire.
Yes.
Well, maybe we should have put a regulation in place.
Right, yeah. So in 2013, mud eruptions from the volcano were so dangerous that scientists refused to go to the island.
And during any stage?
I mean, after those mud explosions in 2013, I don't know if they just like blanket were like, we're never going back, or if it was like at the time, but still. They knew how dangerous this place was, especially when it reaches a certain level.
Yeah, I guess I get it. But also, you're studying it. You should probably go.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they were still doing things to study it, but like they didn't want to like take a tour, you know?
Yeah.
And in October of 2019, volcanic tremors and sulfur dioxide gas were at their highest levels since 2016, which was the last time it had erupted. Which was indicating that an eruption was more likely to occur. On November 24th, 2 weeks before the eruption, a moment magnitude 5.9 earthquake lasting approximately 1 minute with an epicenter located 10 kilometers northeast of White Island occurred and was felt by people throughout New Zealand, which is another indication that it could potentially erupt very soon. So White Island Tours had put out a statement on their website before the eruption that said, quote, "Fakari, White Island is currently on alert level 2. This level indicates moderate to heightened volcanic unrest. There is the potential for eruption hazards to occur. White Island Tours operates through the varying alert levels, but passengers should be aware that there is always a risk of eruptive activity regardless of the alert level. White Island Tours follows a comprehensive safety plan which determines our activities on the island at the various levels." So neither the tour company nor the cruise ship told anyone about that beforehand. So if you were a passenger going on the island that day, the only way you would know before stepping foot on that island that it was potentially an eruption risk was if you went on the website or if you went on like, if you Googled like, what's this volcano's alert level at? Like, you right. wouldn't have known.
So they're just trying to cover their ass for getting sued.
I mean, that tour company, but the cruise ship didn't tell anyone. I don't know if they didn't look into it, but they definitely did not tell anyone, any of their passengers who didn't know anything about this volcano, that there was a heightened risk of eruption. And like, you're on a cruise ship. You have not a care in the world. All you think you have to do is to put on some closed-toed shoes, and you're going to go walk around and see some sulfur crystals and some steam, and it's going to be really great. Because it's like, you know, you want to be taken care of. You're in that like vacation bubble where everything's taken care of for you. A cruise ship is typically all inclusive. Like, you're not thinking about that. You're like, oh, these people are going to take care of me. Wrong. These people were not taking care of you. They didn't tell them anything. Because if they gave these people a warning and said, hey, just so you know, there's a little bit of a heightened risk right now, even if they're kind of sugarcoating it a little bit, the passengers who didn't know anything about this volcano could then make an informed decision to decide if they wanted to go or not. Because so many of the people who ended up on this tour were people who just spontaneously decided to that day because it seemed like a kind of cool thing to do.
Yeah.
But I'm sure like majority of the people who made that decision that day would have thought twice and probably not gone had they known there was any risk of like a true eruption.
Yeah, I get it. I guess at the same time, if you're touring an active volcano and you don't understand that there is at least some risk.
Well, people knew there was some risk, but the difference between being on a quote-unquote active volcano and knowing that there is some risk versus
like
being at a heightened being at a heightened eruption like alert level is very different in my mind.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. I guess like when I keep hearing the language that they're using, like it just kind of seems like the weather. Like they don't know it's moderate or heightened. It's just like, oh, 50% chance of rain.
Sure.
Is it like 50-50? Is it the 1%?
Issue, I think the issue is like it is still kind of an unpredictable thing in that they don't know exactly when it's going to erupt, but it's semi-predictable because they know that it will erupt soon, most likely.
Yeah. If you put it like that, level two means that it will erupt soon, most likely. Like most likely, different than moderate heightened.
Right. Yeah, and I guess it's just really messed up to me because of the 2016 eruption. The only reason that it was okay was because the eruption happened in the middle of the night and nobody was on the island. But the scientists who like looked at this eruption afterward saw exactly where the eruption path was and knew that had anyone been on the island and 18,000 people come every single year, it would have killed them. So it's like, I feel like it was up to someone to give these passengers and like people who are going on the tours that day a little more warning. I mean, especially because the tour guides of the company knew before they even got on the island. But I guess it's like that's not necessarily their job per se to like warn the passengers. I don't know. Because like they were there too. I really don't know. It's just
it
messed
up. It was mishandled.
It was mishandled is my point. But anyway, let's get back to the story. So the steam coming off of the lake around the time that they had learned that this volcano was at a level two started to turn black. And the steam is always white, like almost always.
Sure.
So Crystal and Stephanie and their father had no idea that that was dangerous because this is their first time on the volcano. And so they took a picture in front of the steam vent at the crater. They are at the crater as this is happening. And this is like the last picture before the eruption occurs.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it's like the three of them like smiling with their arms out at the crater. They had no idea that only 7 minutes later, everything would change. After they took their picture, they heard their tour guide at the front of the group scream, "Run."
Oh.
That was when they realized things were very bad. They couldn't even think about anything. They just ran. Crystal's phone was actually still recording her video, so there is footage of the frenzied running and sheer terror as they ran, and you can see the explosion happening. At 2:11 p.m., the volcano had erupted. A massive plume of black and gray smoke exploded out of the top of the volcano. Tourists who were already on their boat leaving the island got a video of the eruption as it happened, and within seconds, the entire island was engulfed in a massive cloud of black ash. They heard the tremendous sound of the explosion and the rocks as they rained down along with the people screaming who were still on the island. Experts identified the event as a phreatic eruption. I hope I'm saying that right. It's a release of steam and volcanic gases that caused an explosion, launching rock and ash into the air. The ash plume rose to 3.7 kilometers or 12,000 feet into the air.
What?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And then it came down and it completely engulfed the entire island. So the people on the boat were stunned at what they were seeing because at first it seemed beautiful and kind of cool that they were able to see this happening in real time. But then they thought to themselves, they had just been on the island only moments before that. And then the horrifying realization hit them that there were still people on the island. Moments before the explosion, the captain of the Phoenix had pointed out the little dots by the crater, and that was the people at the very top of the crater. So they knew that there were people right by the crater as the volcano erupted. One of the passengers on the boat had been recording as it exploded, Alessandro Kaufman, as we talked about in the beginning. So you can see it erupt and then the entire island just disappearing in this massive cloud of ash. The captain of the Vicari boat was still close to the shore and saw the blast happening, grabbed his radio, and shouted, "Evacuate." Brian screamed and yelled to people to dive into the water, and as he dove in himself, two of his German passengers followed him. The other two that were with him didn't make it into the water on time. Moments later, a second burst sent ash, steam, rock, and acid gas barreling across the island and out onto the ocean. These kinds of eruptions happen when superheated water inside the volcano rapidly converts the liquid to steam, and when it erupts, the water and steam can be as hot as 300 degrees Celsius, which is 572 degrees Fahrenheit. And debris was flying at speeds of over 100 meters per second. The blast was so intense that Brian's 1.5-ton helicopter had been thrown from its landing pad, and the rotor was all bent, and like the propeller of the helicopter was completely like bent down and kind of looked like spider legs.
Whoa.
So this 1.5-ton helicopter was thrown and all of the blades were bent. Crazy. It was completely trashed. These explosions are oddly quiet and incredibly quick and relatively unpredictable. As the clouds spilled out over the ocean, the skipper of the Phoenix quickly steered the boat out of harm's way in order to keep the passengers safe and ordered everyone inside the like enclosed little area of the boat. So the Phoenix had to like speed away from this plume of ash and acid, basically, that was coming toward them in the ocean.
And it's all quiet.
Yeah.
That's so eerie.
Yeah. So after the initial explosion, I guess it's pretty quiet as it's like coming at you. Unless you're specifically on the island and then the projectile of like the rocks and everything is going to be quite loud. But in general, it's not like the loudest thing. On the volcano, Stephanie, Crystal, and their father were surrounded by darkness. The visibility went to zero in a matter of seconds, and instantly they couldn't breathe. The air surrounding them had become so hot, it burnt their bodies instantly. The force of the blast was also so significant, it knocked everyone off their feet. Stephanie said, quote, "The force was just that strong, that my whole body was being shoved and pushed and rolled onto the ground, and I was just hitting things while getting burnt at the same time. It was the most terrifying moment of my life." She also said, "The ground was burning hot, and I could tell I was burnt really badly." She could see that nails were hanging off of her hand, and her skin had become loose. They had to seek refuge behind some rocks, and everything was extremely hot. They could feel their skin burning off of them. White hot crystals began hitting them in the head as they rained down. It got worse and worse as time went on. As the clouds settled, the entire surface of the island was covered in gray ash. Once they were out of the way of danger, the Phoenix anchored and set up a rescue operation, launching their inflatable rafts. At that point, 47 people were still on the island, including 38 people from the cruise ship. Kelsey's tour group was down at the shore, but Hayden's group had still been up by the crater. Those inside the Phoenix could see Kelsey's group on the shore, covered head to toe in ash on the landing platform, waiting for the boats. The crew had to get everyone they could onto the inflatable rafts and then back to the Phoenix. It was like a scene out of a horror movie. Everyone was covered head to toe in ash, and people who you came to the island with, like, you couldn't even recognize them because you couldn't make out the features underneath the thick coating of ash. The only help that arrived so far were the little rubber dinghies from the tour company, and those that weren't injured as badly were pushing and scrambling to get onto the small dinghies first because everyone was terrified and it was complete mayhem and madness. Everyone was in a panic and it just became complete chaos. Going down the ladder, one of the survivors said his hand slipped off of the ladder because the skin on his hand had been peeling off as he grabbed on. Getting those who were injured into the rafts and onto the boat was also difficult because, like I said, everyone wanted to be the first one on and everyone was just in a frenzy. The local tour boat then had to start the 90-minute journey back to the mainland, and that boat ride for the survivors of the eruption was agonizing. They were burned so horribly and then had to lay in the sun and get splashed by salt water and have ice-cold air hitting their skin, which was gone in many places, and they said it was just absolutely excruciating. Survivors and passengers asked the crew repeatedly when help was coming, and they expected that search and rescue helicopters would be arriving any minute since they had only been able to rescue the guides, Kelsey and Jake, and the 19 passengers in their tour group, and Brian and his passengers, but the rest of the other tour group was still at the top. Immediately after severe burns like that, a person can still walk and talk since their body hasn't fully registered what has happened, but within minutes, their skin will begin blistering and swelling, and if it's bad enough, your skin can just slide right off. Exposure to toxic gas can also have a delayed effect. Every breath gets harder and a victim can barely breathe in a matter of minutes. You can be fully conscious and talking one minute and dead the next. It's an extremely dangerous situation, so getting everyone off of the island as quickly as possible was critical. Phoenix crew member Paul Kingy boarded the Fikari to search for more survivors with the boat's captain, David Pluse. And as they scanned the island, Paul saw someone emerge from the ash. It was 19-year-old Jesse Langford. He had been in Hayden's group with his parents and his sister and was near Crater Lake during the eruption. It was so incredible that he was still alive and was walking, but his whole body was severely burned, including the skin under his clothes. So Captain David Pluse took Jesse on the Fikari, and Paul stayed behind on the island to help survivors. The people who had multiple protective layers had the worst burns on their hands and faces, but others were only wearing t-shirts and shorts that day, and their entire bodies were burnt from head to toe. The passengers and crew on the boats worked quickly to tend to the burns in the best ways they could, cutting off clothes and cleaning ash from the wounds. They gathered all water bottles they could find and created a human chain to the survivors, pouring water over their burns to cool the temperature. They covered some of the most severe burns with pieces of their clothing and poured water over that to create a second skin for survivors. So people were literally taking off their shirts, like the people who weren't burnt were taking off their shirts and putting it on the severely burnt people and then pouring the water bottle over that, because if they poured the water directly on their skin, it would like essentially come off. So Whoa. Yeah, like these people were burnt like third degree over most of their bodies.
Is there worse than third degree?
Fourth degree burns actually are a thing. I just looked it up, and that includes all the symptoms of a third degree burn and also extends beyond the skin into tendons and bones.
Oof.
So that sounds like you're essentially cremated at that point. Like,
yeah, at least part of you.
Right. But I mean, these people were like third degree burns are really bad.
Oh yeah. Especially all over your body.
Yeah. Like Jesse Langford had third degree burns over 90% of his body.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The slightest gust of wind or sunlight was excruciating for them. They also had thick ash in their eyes, ears, mouths, and noses. Several victims had burns all over their bodies that were swelling and blistering. Some went into shock as their body temperatures plummeted. And passengers who were unharmed did whatever they could to tend to the victims, covering them in tinfoil blankets to keep them warm. And when that wasn't enough, taking their own clothes off of their own bodies to wrap them even more. But back on the mainland, immediately after the eruption, local helicopter pilots had seen the dark smoke rising and jumped into their helicopters without hesitation. John Funnell, a 69-year-old search and rescue service veteran, headed over to the island shortly after the blast. Jason Hill and Tom Story went over together at 2:50, and pilot Mark Law took off a few minutes later. Jason Hill and Tom Story said they only had a standard first aid kit on board their helicopter, but they knew they needed to help. They weren't prepared for what they would find, but they figured something was better than nothing while they waited for search and rescue.
Incredibly brave.
Incredibly brave, because they didn't know if another eruption could occur, which was highly possible, and they're completely risking their lives to try and save whoever they can.
Who they don't even know.
They don't know these people. They also don't have training and don't have equipment. But they're just going out of the good of their hearts to, like, help however they can. It's incredible. They hoped that if anyone was still on the island, that they weren't directly in the blast path or they weren't hurt. But that, unfortunately, was not the case. John Funnell arrived first and was circling the island and had the most experience with rescue operations, so he communicated by cell phone to other pilots and the police and the Coast Guard. Still on the island was Stephanie Browett and 19 other people clinging to life. Stephanie was burned over almost her entire body. She couldn't walk, and she had lost track of her sister, Crystal, and her father, Paul. After a while, she heard her father scream out her name, so she called out yes back to him. Another 20 minutes went by, and he called out again to her, and once again she called back, and then again after some more time, and she realized her father was calling out to check and make sure that she was still awake. She was so happy to hear his voice because she thought that she had lost him. Waiting for help was excruciating. Just staying awake was taking so much energy out of her, she didn't know that she would make it until help arrived. She knew she was getting worse with every second that passed. About an hour had gone by since the eruption, and Tom, Jason, and Mark were the only ones to have arrived on the island to help, other than, like, the Phoenix captain who was getting people off the island just at the very, very bottom, but they weren't up by the crater. They saw the mangled Volcanic Air helicopter that had been thrown from the landing pad and realized just how strong this blast must have been and how hard it would have been for anyone to survive it. When they exited their helicopters, they stepped down into a foot of ash.
A foot? And that happened in...
seconds.
Yeah, like less than a minute?
Yes, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, and even with their glasses and gas masks on, their eyes were burning and their throats were stinging. That's how, like, inhospitable this area was at that time. Steam was still rising, and there was a chance that another eruption could occur at any minute. They had landed their helicopter dangerously close to the crater, but they rushed to help whoever they could, hoping that professional help wasn't far behind them. They were mentally prepared to be helping paramedics, but they were unprepared for the reality of the situation, that they were basically everything they had.
They were the paramedics?
Pretty much. They spotted a group of people near Crater Lake and ran up the path to what they hoped would be survivors, but they were not sure. They found 20 victims below the rim of the crater, and they checked their injuries, put gas masks on them, and gave them water. Some people were unconscious and some were asking for water, and they reassured whoever they could that help was coming and they weren't alone, but they were stunned at the state of the people that they were helping. They were in really bad shape. Stephanie heard the helicopter as it landed, and someone near her got very excited that there was help coming for them. When the men got on the island, everyone was so happy to see them, but then they kept telling the victims help would be coming in another 20 minutes, and they just kept reassuring people that help was on its way, but they didn't know. They found the guides Hayden Marshall Inman and Tippany Mengi near a stream, and both were unresponsive. Based on the footprints on top of the ash and the guide's medical kit nearby, they were able to figure out that Hayden and Tippany had tried to lead the group back down the path after the eruption, and after people fell unconscious, they even put gas masks on them. Hayden had also tried to go back and help more people, and he may have actually been able to make it to the shore, but he chose to stay behind and help. Isn't that incredible?
Is he, like, awake?
Not at that point, no. He was unresponsive.
So he passed out trying to help people?
Yes.
Wow.
Tippany had also attempted to lead people back down to the shore. She had led a girl named Winona and Jesse Langford down the path, but only Jesse made it to the shore. Mark, Tom, and Jason did whatever they could for the survivors, still reassuring them that help would be there any minute. But then Jason received crushing news. John Funnel, who had been circling the island, was in contact with emergency services and told them that help wasn't coming.
What?
There was a fleet of 11 search and rescue helicopters that had been sitting nearby, but they decided they couldn't make the 20-minute trip to White Island because it was too dangerous.
What? Guys, this is your job.
Yeah.
I guess how did they come to that determination?
Dr. Tony Smith was a part of that decision. He said the information that they had been receiving at the time led them to believe it wasn't safe to land on the island. So instead, the crews were told that they would receive casualties at Whakatane and then transport them to burn units across the country instead of going to the island and saving people's lives.
So these two amateurs are the only help.
Three, but yes.
Three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and their helicopters weren't equipped to take multiple people off the island. They still had
seats. Five?
And yeah, exactly. They had room for like four people at a time, basically. But these this Dude. Fleet of search and rescue helicopters. They had 11 search and rescue helicopters, all of which were massive and like had space to load people into them, probably laying down on the floor, you know, instead of having to be sat up in like uncomfortable seats after being burnt over 70% of your body. Like it is unbelievable that these local helicopter pilots who have absolutely no training whatsoever jumped in and risked their lives, and a fleet of 11 helicopters from search and rescue were not able to go because of the decision of like, I don't know, two guys. I guess I don't know how many people made that decision, but like none of them went. So it's unbelievable.
Yeah. I don't know. Imagine like a firefighter.
Yeah.
Like standing outside a burning building and being like, yeah, it's too dangerous.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I guess maybe that happens, but I don't know. This seems extraordinary to me.
Yeah, this was insane. And they have recently gone back on it and been like, well, that was probably the wrong call.
Yeah, I don't know, dude. It's like 20 people's lives. Ugh.
When the three local pilots heard that help wasn't coming, they knew that they were it. So they decided they had to get as many people off of the island as they could, one way or another. They didn't have all the right equipment. They didn't really have any equipment. So Jason ran back down the path to get their helicopter and bring it closer to the victims. Stephanie's dad, Paul, got their attention, and he told Jason and Tom to take his daughters first. When they found Stephanie, she was very badly burnt. She was not doing well, but she was conscious. So Jason and Tom lifted her up and carried her into their helicopter. They told her she was going to be okay and placed her in the front seat. They managed to get Stephanie and her father into the helicopter and three other survivors, so there were five people in total. Jason then took off at 3:48 p.m. with those passengers and left Tom on the island to help anyone else he could. Jason knew that every minute counted. He had a 20-minute flight back to the mainland, and the entire time he was yelling at the passengers to keep them awake. He wasn't sure if they were all still alive, but he was doing everything he could to keep them alert, because they also had to kind of make a split-second decision on who to take, because they had to save people who had a fighting chance. Like, there were some people who were already dead, so these people who are completely inexperienced and are also kind of fighting for their lives at this point, they have to, like, decide who goes and who doesn't.
Yeah. Wait, so search and rescue knows that these people are on the island?
Yeah, I believe so. They've because
been in contact with them?
Right, so the guy, I believe his name was John Funnel something. He was a search and rescue veteran. He's circling the island in his helicopter, and he's in contact with both the three pilots on the ground on the volcano and also search and rescue. So search and rescue knows that there is people on the island who are attempting to be saved. Or who they're attempting to save. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Sorry. So there's two helicopters that have landed on the island?
Mm-hmm. Two.
So we have a veteran circling who is a part of search and rescue.
He's a veteran. He's not active. But yes, he was like at this point just a local pilot who was circling the island as well.
Okay. And then we had one helicopter land and take people.
Yes.
Okay.
Jason and Tom were together in their one helicopter, and then Mark was in another helicopter. And Jason took off with the five passengers and left Tom and Mark on the island to keep helping people.
Okay. So a second helicopter is on the island or circling?
A second helicopter is on the island. Mark's helicopter.
Okay.
But now Jason is in the air with the five passengers going back to the mainland to get them help. And Stephanie felt like...
This is so extraordinary because the search and rescue people know that there's two helicopters on the island saving people.
Correct.
And they're like, we're good.
Mm-hmm. They said it was too dangerous.
They're like, yeah, you're already there. You guys got it. That's insane, dude.
I know.
Wow. Okay. Keep going.
Okay. So Stephanie said she felt like her body wanted to shut down. All she could hear was Jason yelling at her to stay awake. And she was in so much pain and wanted desperately to give in to her body, but she thought to herself if she closed her eyes, she wasn't sure that she would ever wake up. She did everything she could to keep herself awake despite how painful it was. And Mark got his helicopter next, so I guess he brought it closer to where the victims were as well. And Tom realized that several people who were alive when they got there were now sadly deceased. And they loaded up Mark's chopper with five victims who were still alive at the time, or what they hoped were alive. Around 3:05, the last helicopter piloted by Tim Barrow and Graham Hopcraft arrived, and Mark directed them to the final surviving victims. So now another helicopter has landed, not search and rescue.
Wait, who's the third helicopter?
These are just two other pilots. Tim Barrow and Graham Hopcraft. And so among the first to be loaded was Lisa Dallow, who they knew was alive since after asking Tom for water, she had started throwing up blood and ash. So they knew she was alive. And in all, these pilots picked up 12 people in 40 minutes.
Wow.
As I've said, these were not trained search and rescue people, but they risked their lives and saved as many people as they could. And even more extraordinary, Tom stayed back and gathered the bodies of the dead so they'd be easier to move when a helicopter came back for them. So he maneuvered people's bodies over rocks and across streams to drag them and carry them into one spot. So this one helicopter pilot, after all the what they believe is all the surviving victims are gone, and he's like, let me make this easier for people and I'll put people's bodies together and like have them be easy to be identified and to be picked up.
Wow. This is truly selfless. This is truly like remarkable.
I know. Yeah. And everywhere he went, he found phones, which he tucked into the owner's hands as a way to identify them. And he also noticed which bodies were wearing Ovation of the Seas identification tags. So he's doing a lot. Like, he's not just moving bodies. He's, like, putting phones with them to identify them. He's trying to keep track of everyone. It's really insane.
And he's not trained in search and rescue?
No.
He just figured it out?
Yeah.
Common sense. Wow.
It's incredible.
What a hero.
I know. John Funnell was still circling overhead and radioed down when a search and rescue chopper finally arrived. Medical director Tony Smith was on board, and Tom met them on the shore and said there were 8 bodies and no more survivors. And they ordered him to leave the island immediately, since it wasn't safe to be there anymore, especially since there were no more survivors. They said, cool, now get out.
If I'm him, I'm like, yeah, dude, I've been here.
Yeah.
For 40 minutes.
Yeah, over 40 minutes at this point. The Coast Guard met the Phoenix before it had reached the shore and boarded to start treating the injured while they were still, I guess, going to the mainland. Passengers who had been able to walk aboard were now moaning and screaming as their burns swelled and blistered. Tongues were puffing, throats were closing. They couldn't tolerate the wind or sunlight, and they shivered uncontrollably. It was a disaster. Medical professionals and ambulances were waiting on the mainland to take survivors to the hospital. By the time Jason landed his helicopter back at Fukutani Hospital, it had been 2 hours since the eruption. Stephanie, along with the other survivors, were rushed into the emergency room, and both Stephanie and her father had to be placed in medically induced comas. Crystal, very tragically, had succumbed to her injuries and was one of the bodies that was still on the island. Stephanie didn't find out about her sister's death until she came out of her coma. And 4 weeks after the eruption, Paul also sadly passed due to his injuries. It's just awful. But going back to the day of the eruption, it wasn't until 2.5 hours after the eruption that search and rescue was eventually on the island. And as we know, all the survivors had been taken off of the island. Dr. Tony Smith, who was with search and rescue, had said that after reflection, they now know they could have flown to the island earlier, but even if they had made it to the island sooner, he's confident no other lives would have been saved.
I don't know how the fuck you can say that.
Yeah. I truly don't know how he believes that,
like,
because...
Like, do you think we're stupid?
Right. Like, with burns as severe as...
For what reason?
...they were dealing with, it's crucial to get victims to the hospital as quickly as possible. So this, like, idea of the golden hour is talked about in, I guess, trauma care and medicine, and it refers to the critical first hour after a traumatic injury when prompt medical intervention can significantly improve survival and reduce long-term complications. Within that hour, you have the highest likelihood that prompt medical and surgical treatment will prevent death. And search and rescue didn't show up to the island until 2.5 hours later.
The fact that, I mean, it's laughable that he said that. Based on what medical background do you have?
I mean, he's a search and rescue guy, so he's trained.
You're not a doctor, though.
That's true, but
how
he is
trained.
How are you
confident that nobody else would have survived?
He was trying to save face. I don't even
I
think
know,
he believes that.
I know, but, you know, he still said it.
No, I
in a
yeah.
public statement.
Yes, he did. He totally did.
On behalf of Search and Rescue.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And he was one of the people involved in the decision to not send them to the island.
Yeah, dude. I mean, you got to live with that. Like, you made a decision, and, like, when you make that decision, you have to be okay with, you have to be okay with everyone dying because you didn't go. That is kind of what you have to be okay with in the worst case. And, you know, to say that, like, with no basis in reality, like, you don't think that getting there quicker had any chance of helping anyone? I mean, that's ludicrous.
Yeah, I mean, when they were made aware of the eruption, I mean, everyone knew it happened when it happened because it shot 12,000 feet in the air.
And then amateur pilots immediately
right.
jumped into action.
But they had a fleet, as I've said, of 11 helicopters that were all equipped with, you know, medical stuff, medical equipment, and they were they had room to load a bunch of people onto their helicopters. I believe two of their helicopters flew like really fast, and like the flight was 20 minutes. So sure, they would have been cutting it close within that golden hour time period because it would have taken 20 minutes to get there and 20 minutes to get back. But like the other pilot managed to do it with his one helicopter that he could only fit 5 people in. And had zero medical equipment. Like, they 100% could have saved more lives, in my opinion. It's just, it's unbelievable.
Yeah,
the mental gymnastics they're going through.
Right. I mean, we don't know for sure.
No, of course
but,
not.
But, you know, if there was any chance of saving extra lives, you didn't take it.
No, yeah. They didn't give anyone a fighting chance.
And it's like, yeah, okay, it's still, you're probably going to take an hour to get there and back, but you could have gotten somebody who is at least an EMT, like has some medical training,
right? That's my point.
For emergencies like this,
right?
And for burns to help these people,
exactly,
and give them the best shot. So
it's just heartbreaking,
man. Yeah.
It's also like so many people, sorry to interrupt you, risked their lives and were so selfless in this situation, like specifically the tour guides who could have potentially made it back to the shore but chose to go back and help people. They lost their lives. And also the helicopter pilots who went there, who were just local pilots, didn't know, you know, if another eruption could occur, like, or would occur. Like, they knew it could happen. They knew they were risking their lives. And that guy, Tom, stayed back and put all the people's bodies in one place, like even continued to risk his life, even for people past being alive. So it's just, it is unbelievably disappointing. Disappointing is an understatement. For this whole search and rescue situation, it's just, it's unreal. Yeah.
Like, I understand, like, in situations like these, like, you hear about it, you just want to be mad. Like, you want to be mad at somebody.
Yeah.
And I don't know. This is a pretty easy target.
Yeah, I'm mad.
Yeah.
And the survivors are mad, too.
Yeah.
Because there aren't many of them, you know?
I know. Oh, it's just horrific.
It is horrific. It really is.
But, I mean, at the same time, it's just like a tragedy.
It's a whole, yeah.
It's just like a random thing that just happened to be that day.
I know. Yeah, and two boats had already gone. You know, they were on their way back down. And I don't know if that was the last tour of the day, but it was close to it, I think.
Yeah.
It's insane. So Stephanie is one of the most severely injured. She has burns all over her body. She had to have 8 fingers amputated and has had more than 20 operations. And Dr. Tony Smith wouldn't say how much longer Stephanie would have survived on the island had she not been taken when she was. And she felt like she absolutely would have died had she not been taken when she was. But this was another example of him being like, oh, she probably would have survived regardless. So it's fine that we didn't go there earlier. It's just
I've had enough from him.
No, I know. We can move on. But anyway, passengers on the Royal Caribbean cruise ship didn't even know that the volcano had erupted. Some people found out through loved ones who saw it on the news and called them. There wasn't an announcement that was made. And when people did try to finally get information about their loved ones who had been on the tours that day, they weren't told anything and were just put in a room to wait. So there were people's loved ones dying in the hospital and their family was put in a room on the cruise ship and were not told anything.
Well, that is unacceptable.
Yeah. 47 people were on the island at the time of the eruption, and the eruption killed 22 people and severely injured 25. There had been a mudslide that night, and some of the bodies had been washed away. So they were able to recover 6 of the 8 bodies that were left on the island, and that was days after, because search and rescue didn't even take people that day. They waited, and then there was a mudslide that took 2 people away, and they were never found.
Wow. Also after, what was his name, Tom?
Yeah.
After Tom, like, wrapped the job up with a bow, you know, put all the bodies in one place mm-hmm. with ID,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't just go do that?
No, they told
him. Took you like 5-10 minutes?
Yeah, they told him to get off the island, and then they also left, which cost 2 people.
Yeah, like, what the fuck did you get into search and rescue for? Near a volcano, you know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Ostensibly, you have 11 helicopters for that reason. You're paid to do it.
They also didn't even have to land, because those search and rescue helicopters save people out of the ocean. They could have just lowered like a basket and had people be loaded into the basket and then flown them, you know, away, or like loaded them up into the helicopter while they were hovering in the air. They didn't even have to land. With 11 helicopters, they could have gotten everyone off of the island within that 40 minutes. Easy. Because within the 3 helicopters, they managed to get 12 people off the island. And those were not set up for this search and rescue situation. So it's just yeah. the whole thing is like, what?
Yeah, it makes you really mad.
Yeah.
Can you sue the search and rescue team?
There were a lot of lawsuits. So we'll talk about that too. 2 people rescued by helicopters survived, Stephanie Browett and a woman named Lisa Dallow. And the other 10 sadly died. Several people lived for days or weeks after the eruption, but then died from their injuries. The survivors had traumatic injuries that will affect them for the rest of their lives, severe burns to their skin, lungs, and many of them needing amputations. Collectively, they had the equivalent of 16 bodies worth of skin grafts.
Oh my God.
After 25 operations to treat burns covering 80% of his body, Jake Milbank wrote his thanks to his supporters, who raised him $87,700 to pay for his treatment, so that's pretty cool. Kelsey Waghorn, who underwent 14 surgeries of her own for 45% burns, wrote to her donors, who raised $68,580 for her, saying, "I'll just keep pushing forward and hope that that will do for now." One of the most extraordinary survival stories belongs to Jesse Langford. Despite suffering burns over 90% of his body during his run through the crater, the 19-year-old was able to write a eulogy for his father, mother, and sister, who were on the tour with him from the hospital bed in Sydney, and he had to watch the live stream of their funeral while he was in the hospital. And he said, quote, "The past weeks have taught me that when times are tough, you have to find that inner strength that pushes you to persevere. You always have a bit more in you." It's so tragic to think what these families went through, because these tours, this was like a family cruise that people were on, and they're taking tours with their families.
God, I can't even. Did he have any family left?
I don't know.
Like immediate? Like your whole immediate family dies in one day?
Yeah.
On a vacation.
Right. Yeah.
Not only that, they didn't warn you about it.
Right.
Search and rescue didn't respond.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to watch a live stream of their funeral.
Yeah. With burns over 90% of your body.
Oh my God.
Which is something that you could easily die from in recovery.
Yeah. Try and keep a positive outlook after that.
I know. And it
my
seems
God.
He did. I mean, he said, you always have a bit more in you. So. That's pretty positive.
It's just, I can't even begin to imagine.
No.
Where you go inside yourself to find that.
No, I have no idea. Yeah.
Bit more.
Yeah. And Stephanie's recovery has also been long and painful. She suffered severe burns over 70% of her body, including her face, hands, legs, abdomen, back, and chest. She suffered from full thickness burns, which are also known as third degree burns, which affect all layers of the skin and sometimes the fat, muscles, and nerves underneath. Her surgeries, which were at first conducted every other day, involved the debridement or removal of dead tissue and the application of grafts crafted from donated skin as well as her own. Her healing was also facilitated by hyperbaric chambers, various forms of therapy, including speech sessions, laser treatments, and whole body compression garments. She had to relearn so much. She has talked about how she was basically like an infant. She had to relearn how to like eat and walk and speak, basically. It was really difficult. She was released from the hospital in May of 2020 and reunited with her mother, Marie, and her collie, Arlo. The survivors are, understandably, extremely angry at the search and rescue for not coming sooner, because lives very well may have been saved if they had. They're also angry at the cruise ship for not giving them any proper warning. After everything, there were a ton of investigations and lawsuits. WorkSafe, which is New Zealand's workplace and health and safety regulator under the Department of Labor, was formed in 2013 to oversee regulations on the adventure tourism industry in New Zealand, and operators who failed to comply with regulations could get 5 years in prison and up to $1 million in fines. Charges were filed in November of 2020 against 10 organizations and 3 individuals involved in tour operations. The investigation found that tour operators didn't follow health and safety rules and that the eruption was foreseeable. A New Zealand court has ordered $10 million in compensation to the victims of the White Island volcano disaster. The firm that owns the island and those that operated tours were found guilty of negligence and safety breaches. The court said their failure to provide proper checks had ruined many lives. It also found that the operators had ignored the signs of heightened activity in the weeks leading up to the eruption on the island. The court also ordered White Island Tours, the company which had brought the tourists to the island for a walking tour, to pay $4.68 million in reparations. 3 other tour companies, Volcanic Air Safaris, Arius Limited, and Kahu New Zealand Limited, were also ordered to pay damages. Separately, GNS Science, a government-owned research body that monitored New Zealand's volcanoes, was ordered to pay a fine of $54,000 for inadequately communicating with contractors about the risks on White Island. And payments were divided among the victims, with larger amounts for the families of the 22 people who were killed. The cruise passengers were given the equivalent of 1 day fare aboard the ship as compensation.
Oh, the ones who didn't have any...
I guess, yeah.
Anything happened to them?
Or even the people who were on the tour. Like, that was what the cruise ship was going to do. They're like, oop, you can have
that
one.
That was their first offer?
Pretty much, yeah. 1 free day. Sorry we didn't tell you. Here's a free day on the cruise.
I mean, it's a joke.
Yes, that's laughable.
So what, $100?
I don't know how much a day cost on the cruise, but it's not
more
that much.
More than 1,000?
Maybe, I don't know.
Less than 1,000?
Probably less than 1,000, yeah. I don't know. But Sydney-based lawyer Rita Yosef became a spokesperson for many of the survivors and family members of the deceased, and she believed that it was the responsibility of Royal Caribbean Cruise Line to be monitoring the risk factors of visiting an active volcano and communicating that risk to the passengers so that they could make an informed decision. Later in 2020, passengers and family members started filing lawsuits against Royal Caribbean in Miami, Florida, which is where the headquarters are, for failing to warn them of the potential dangers of visiting White Island. Lawsuits were filed by multiple survivors, including Stephanie Browett. In December of 2020, Royal Caribbean filed lawsuits in Australia back against the survivors, including Stephanie. Claiming a clause in the ticket contract says only courts in New South Wales, Australia can hear legal disputes related to the eruption, and ask the courts to prevent the victims from pursuing legal action in the United States. So they countersued the victims and the families who lost their loved ones.
Scumbags.
Due to their negligence.
Because they know that the U.S., like, civil court, they're going to get a big settlement.
I mean, how evil do you have to be to sue people who are fighting for their lives in the hospital and families who lost their loved ones from something you did?
They just care only about money.
Yeah, disgusting. After everything, journalists have continuously asked the question why people would want to go on an active volcano in the first place. But as I said in the very beginning, statistically speaking, it's not a dangerous thing to do. You're much more likely to die mountain climbing, boating, swimming, or even driving a car than you are to die on an active volcano in an eruption.
Seriously?
I mean, it happens infrequently enough, I guess. So statistically, you're safe, but it does happen.
Well, how many people are on an active volcano? How do you come up with, like, statistically you're more safe on an active volcano? Dude, nobody goes on an active volcano.
Yeah, you're only there for like an hour.
Where did you get that?
Google. I Googled
word,
it.
Word. I thought this was coming from Royal Caribbean.
No.
Like, wouldn't that be their case in court, though?
I mean, I wouldn't doubt it.
Because some lawyer somewhere has to come up with the best defense of their position, which is just going to be ridiculous.
Yes. They also can't fight the fact that, like, there had been multiple warnings from scientists and other, like, volcanic tracking organizations, whatever, saying that this volcano is going to erupt soon. Like, their risk management team
I mean, they
should
didn't
have...
say that.
No, they did.
They didn't say it was going to. They said, like, what, moderately heightened?
I don't know the exact wording off the top of my head, but, like, it seemed as if it was, like, we're in a level two. It's been weeks into a level two. There's heightened volcanic activity. There is a good chance of an eruption. Yeah. We just don't know when, especially because, like, the levels of whatever thing they were testing was as high as it was in 2016 when the last eruption had happened. So it's like they had the science to be like, hey, this is not the safest thing to be doing right now. And still nobody was told anything and nothing was done to protect the general public from going to the island.
Yep. Time to pay up.
Yeah. Obviously, tourism activities on White Island have not resumed since the eruption. But to end on a better note, Stephanie Browett has made incredible progress in her recovery. She is just an incredible person. She has made TikToks and Instagram reels explaining her injuries and recovery process. And in most of her videos, she's like smiling and upbeat while explaining such traumatic things. And she's just so inspirational and is such a bright light in general. She has said, learning to love myself in my new skin has taken time. I was extremely self-conscious and worried about being judged every day. But since then, she has come so far. In March, she actually posted on Instagram about wearing a two-piece bathing suit in public again, which is something she loved doing. She loved going to the beach and like feeling the sun on her skin. And that has taken so much time for her to be comfortable doing that and learning to love herself again. But she has really been thriving and like learning to find her personal style and is just coming into her own once again, which I think is really beautiful. And her goal is to advocate for other burn survivors like herself by sharing her story on social media. And her Instagram and TikTok following is around 2 million people from people all over the world. And she has said, representation truly matters. When it comes to healing, I needed that as I was recovering. Seeing other people with burns and living a good life gave me hope that my future wasn't all lost. So she's really incredible. And also, the helicopter pilots who risked their lives to save people on the volcano are heroes. Just as a little button on the very end of there. Jason, Tom, yeah. And Mark. They're incredible.
Amen to that. Yeah, they deserve whatever, like, what is it? Like the highest civilian honor you can get. It's like Medal of Freedom or something.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I don't know if it's called that, but they need the New Zealand version of that.
Sure. Yeah, totally.
For sure.
I totally agree. But yeah, that's the story of the White Island volcano eruption.
Yeah, wow.
I just can't even, like, begin to wrap my head around, like, not only like how hot that steam and, you know, projectiles and everything would have been, but also it was like acid steam.
Yeah,
like not only is it like hot steam and stuff that's burning you, but the acid is burning you too.
Yeah, and then you have to go buy salt water.
Yeah, I just can't imagine how scary that must have been.
Oof.
It's a horrifying thing to think about. So the fact that anyone made it out of there and has any kind of positive attitude about everything is incredible. Stephanie Browett is amazing. Like, watching her videos is extremely inspirational. So I encourage you to check her out and, you know, support her on social media because she's really great.
Are they still in litigation, or do we know how much Royal Caribbean had to pay, or did they uphold, like, oh, you can't be sued in the U.S.?
I don't know how much they ended up paying people, but I do know that like lawsuits with the victims and their families were settled out of court or something. Or I don't know if it was settled out of court, but they were settled privately is what I could gather. So I think they did end up paying people because they had to, like they didn't do it out of the kindness of their heart, but
they did have to
pay people. I don't know how the amount, but yeah. I hope it was a lot.
Better be.
Why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser and you can tell me something good. What is your good thing?
Well, in my indoor garden, I have the first cherry tomato that is ripe.
I love that.
Which is cool.
Your garden is really popping off.
It is popping off, and it's cool because I can pick it and eat it.
You're also making dirt now. You're composting.
Oh my God. I bought a Lomi composter, and it's basically like this massive, really slow microwave you put food scraps in, and like what comes out on the other side is like
is dirt.
Loose leaf tea.
It's basically dirt.
It's kind of dirt. It's like pre-dirt.
Yeah. So every day when I eat my banana, I hand him my peel and say, this is for your dirt.
Yeah. And I appreciate it.
That's about
adding to my dirt.
All I know about your dirt.
And then it goes in the garden. And then you're supposed to feel good about yourself because you reduced waste.
Sure. So love that.
I guess that could be another good thing, you know? More dirt for me.
My good thing is dirt.
How fun.
Very good.
Didn't think I would be here. But what's your good thing?
My good thing is that yesterday I had a like full spring cleaning mode activate, and I like built the bike rack for your office, so it's like,
yes, thank you,
less
for doing that.
Cluttered with our two bikes, and I put up some string lights and I cleaned the whole place top to bottom, so that was pretty good. Although I am sore today. Quite sore. My legs are not happy with me.
Right.
But I don't know, it needed to happen, and it felt good afterward, regardless of my legs being sore. So
you popped off, and it feels good in the brain, not in the body.
Yeah, right. My body is tired today. But that's okay.
I do appreciate it. It's a different feeling when you kind of walk around, there's like nothing to be done.
There's not two bikes.
Things are
cluttering your office.
Right. Things are where they're supposed to be.
Loving that. But yeah, anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to check out our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. We post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram @nottoday_podcast. We also have the link to our merch shop in our Instagram bio. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.